Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here with episode 111 and part one of my conversation with longtime Florida State University percussion professor, John W. Parks IV. We'll get to him in a moment. First up, homecoming. Good Lord, that was a long day. Mizzou, being the birthplace of homecoming, knows how to make good use of its band by working them the whole day. We had our homecoming parade to begin, which luckily began at the much better time of 9 a.m. versus the ridiculous time of 7:30 a.m. the previous year. That was followed with a band practice at 11, game at 3, and then the Mizzou Madness, which usually you think of as Midnight Madness, which began an hour after the end of the football game. And that, of course, is the official beginning of men's and women's college basketball season. So many of our students had 14-hour day on a Saturday. That's a lot. Everything seemed to go well, though, and I was quite pleased. And tired. Very, very, very tired. Looking forward to sleeping in 2025. It's possible that I had met John Parks at some earlier point at some PASIC many years ago, but it was great to get a chance to talk to him at length. I'd heard him on other podcasts, I'd read his blog posts, I'd seen his ensembles play frequently at PASIC, and I'd gotten to know a lot about him and his program from numerous previous guests who were his former students, which include my colleague and frequent Pete's Percussion Podcast guest, Megan Arnes. As we started the interview, it became clear, after a short time, that this one was going to need to be split up into two parts. John has accomplished an enormous amount in his career, including teaching, research, performing, service, and his other ongoing career as a recording engineer. There's a lot to get to. And for those of you who know him, you know that he's got a lot of strong, entertaining opinions that he has no problem sharing and backing up. And he'll throw in some salty language for emphasis. So here we go! We recorded this part of the interview over Skype on October 18th, 2018, and it begins right now.
What's your preferred way of being introduced?
I don't care. John W. Parks IV is fine. John Parks is fine.
Okay.
Asshole is fine. I don't care.
I like where we're starting. You getting the position at Florida State and okay. Where you were before then and the process for getting the job, et cetera.
Okay. Well, I was at the University of Kansas for 3 years, from 2000 to 2003. And this was right after I finished at Eastman. Mm-hmm. And I remember clearly I got an email from Jeff Moore, one of my best friends. You guys know each other. He now is like the provost president slash pope at UCF.
Right.
And well-deserved, too. Yeah. I mean, they're really lucky to have him. But he sent me an email, and he said, Wertesheim's out. He's retiring. John Beck Jr. is going to be there on the 1 year. And I remember looking at the computer screen, and I said, I'm going to get that job no matter what. And I remember several of my friends were like, that job's too big. There's no way you're going to get it, you know, et cetera. And I was like, well, you watch. And that's the only thing you have to do is tell me that I can't do something and then it's going to happen. And I got really lucky through a confluence of people that I knew and stuff that was happening. And it just so happened that because of the way that they advertised it, it caught a lot of people out of the running. So
what was the
assistant?
What was the kind of in there that you could see that was for that you're like, I can do this is for me, like I can see right now.
It was assistant level, so that cut out a lot of people that were already tenured or associate or higher at a lot of other schools that FSU might have been a step up for them, but the pay was going to be a serious cut for them.
Sure.
Additionally, they wanted an orchestra specialist. Which that was my thing, right? So, and half of my interview recital was excerpt playing. I mean, it wasn't just, come in and, play excerpts for a clinic. I mean, it was come in and play excerpts like an audition in front of a committee, because part of the gig at the time was to come in and also play with the local orchestra here, but you know, they really wanted to kind of step up the orchestra placement and conservatory placement of the graduates. So in that way, it was right up my alley. Whereas if it had been something like, you know, world music, or we want you to teach jazz vibraphone or something like that, I probably wouldn't. I mean, I would have applied for it anyway, but I wouldn't have been able to fill out those other things because that's not really what I do. So it just ended up, I mean, it was basically written for me. And at the time, one of our music education faculty, Alison Darrow, had also been recruited to come here. And our trumpet professor at Kansas had also been recruited to come here. So we all three came at the same time. So FSU was a really bad acronym around the University of Kansas Department of Music, you know, for a semester. But it ended up being great, and I brought a bunch of students with me from Lawrence, including, I think there were four grad students. So it was really nice at first because they had been working with me for 2 years at least at Kansas and kind of knew all my quirks and knew how I wanted things to run. And so it was really nice to have kind of an assistant coaching staff, you know, to be able to come in with me and help me kind of figure everything out right off the bat. So that was really important and very helpful.
Yeah.
So here we are. This is my 16th year, I think. I'm not very good at math, but I think it's my 16th year.
Gotcha. What time of year was this, was your interview?
The interview was in the spring, which was really kind of crazy because I had given my first clinic at Midwest in the December beforehand. And it was really kind of wild because I was there with Kansas at college night, and this guy comes walking over to me. And you've been to Midwest, you know how this stuff works. And so they have college night where all the kids can walk through and meet all the people from the music schools. And this guy comes up to me, and his name tag's turned around backwards, and it was the chair of the search committee. And he comes over to me, and he grabs me, and he's like, "How about taking a walk with me?" And he takes me over to the FSU booth. And so I meet the dean and the associate dean and, you know, all the other deans and, you know, blah, 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 and we're talking and everything. And I had a clinic the next day. And they were all there. So that helped a lot. But then what happened was I went to go visit one of my friends from Northwestern. And I was playing soccer with his daughter in their basement. And we're running around with our socks on. And I blew my knee out. Yeah, I slipped on the floor and, like, ran my knee into the wood floor. And I didn't know I had done it at the time. I mean, it hurt, but I didn't know. I was still able to walk. And so anyway, I get back to the hotel, right? And I go to the hotel bar to hang out. And for some reason, like, there was cartilage that was floating around in my knee.
Oh.
And a piece of it got stuck in my leg when it was extended, and I couldn't bend it. So here we are. It's like 10 o'clock on, you know, Friday night or, you know, whatever day it was, Saturday night.
Yeah.
At the Hilton bar. And I'm having to be carried out. And I haven't even had anything to drink. And I'm having to be carried out and put into a cab and taken downtown to Northwestern General, you know, or Northwestern University's hospital, the general hospital downtown, not the one in Evanston. And I'm in the ER with Matt McCutcheon. He's the director of bands now at the University of South Florida. He's one of my best friends. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in the ER, like, all night long, waiting to figure out what's wrong with my leg, right? So then I have to fly back, you know, and get, like, a wheelchair and, you know, have to brave O'Hare, which was just a nightmare. So I get home, get knee surgery, and I can't walk. And then I find out, okay, I'm a finalist for this thing. I'm going to have to give a recital. I'm going to need to stand up, and I'm going to be playing marimba and other things. I'm going to need to be able to walk. So fortunately, through PT and everything else, I was able to start walking after about 3 weeks. And I had several, you know, weeks after that to kind of get back in shape and do what I needed to do in order to be able to come down for the interview. So I think I had I remember it was the weekend of the last audition day at the University of Kansas, so it must have been like the end of February, and they actually offered me the job while I was here. So I was able to go back and talk to the dean and the chair and everybody and tell them that next week, which gave them plenty of time to run a search, which was really important to me, and my good friend Kevin Bobo ended up coming in right after, which was really cool. As well, and, you know, obviously there have been a lot of terrific teachers since then at Kansas, but I've been here since then, and that was that. But yeah, it was kind of crazy, man.
Did you at least like ask for some tequila shots, like as you were leaving the bar? Like, if I'm gonna get carried out, no, I might as well get
no,
a little.
You know, that was the thing. I was like, I don't know what the hell's wrong with my leg. Like, this is ridiculous. You know, and of course back then it was like people had flip phones. Like, right. You couldn't even text people. This right. is a long time ago. This is like 2002, yeah. something like that. So anyway, yeah, it was kind of nuts. But Matt, he's a good man. He stayed with me the whole time. And let me tell you something. On a Saturday night in downtown Chicago in the emergency room, you see some stuff. You know, I'm telling you. Yeah, I mean, you see some stuff. There was one guy who, like, came in and he looked like he had half of a beer bottle stuck in his head. And, you know, of course, they're not going to mess with me. I'm just sitting there telling him I can't bend my leg. You know, the people come in, they got, like, bleeding head wounds and stuff. And they're getting right back there, and Matt and I are just sitting there like, you know, we're at a band convention. I can't bend my leg, and I got a flight, you know, back to Kansas in like 8 hours from trying to figure it out. I mean, it was pretty funny. So anyway, that's how I got the job.
Yeah.
So I was happy. I was, you know, not on crutches when I got here for the interview.
When you come in, do you, I'm curious, do you ask to do anything in terms of like a shortened period for promotion as part of your contract?
You can do that, but typically Florida State does not look at that at all. Like, for example, Rick Clary, who's our graduate wind conductor, he came in. He was a full professor at the University of Kentucky. He came in basically as a full professor but untenured. So he had to go through the six-year process just like all of us did. I mean, when I came in, there were 9 of us that were new. In the program, and all of them, I think, were tenured, and at least I think all of them were associate or full, except for me. Like, I had never been anywhere long enough. I'd only taught at Samford for 3 years and at Kansas for 3 years, but there wasn't even a discussion of will I have any time going forward. And the argument from the dean was, look, we've vetted people so seriously, and before we even offer them positions here, we don't hire people that won't get tenure. So, you know, you just do what you're supposed to do and actually look at it this way. If you do screw up, you've got time to fix it. Whereas, you know, on a shortened track, it may not be that way. Now, for some people that, you know, might have been a problem, for me, it was fine. I was a finalist for the Northwestern job back in 2008. And that would have been, like, I would have gone in and that there wouldn't have been a shortened track for that. I would have asked for tenure right off the bat. And promotion at that point. And that would have been a standard thing for a school at that level at that point in my career. But, you know, a young person going in that's just got a couple of years teaching somewhere, that conversation can happen, but typically that's going to come from the administrator because they know how many years you've got. And more often than not, they'll probably say no. So it just depends.
Yeah. When you went up for the Northwestern job, were you, was that at a time where you were going from in a promotion year, or was that just because that was a job you were interested in looking at?
It was a promotion year, but it was also like that was the only job in the country that I think I would have been interested in, and still is the only job that I've applied for since I've been here, just because I had 2 degrees from there. Mike was and still is one of my best friends and mentors, and I had a lot of students from Florida State who were in that studio. And that place has meant so much to me, and I wanted to be part of the, you know, the tradition moving forward if they wanted it. And the other finalists were all just fabulous.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was so honored to be in that list of people that actually got to visit. And, you know, I just wanted the place to be in good hands, and, you know, it all worked out the way that it did. And, you know, everybody's, I think, really happy with how they all landed. Certainly I am.
Yeah.
Would have been a tough call, though. You know, I love this place, and I mean, I don't know what would have happened, but fortunately, I didn't have to make that decision.
At Florida State, what are the ways that the job has changed, or your responsibilities have changed or remained the same over the years?
that's a good question. Well, the short version is, you probably know this. Florida State, the College of Music, is the 3rd largest in the country. We have over 1,100 music majors. We're behind Indiana and North Texas, respectively.
Yeah.
But the percussion studio, I mean, we really need probably 50 in order to make everything work smoothly around here.
You mean to fit all the ensembles?
To fit everything, to make sure that everybody's not literally, you know, playing in like 5 groups and, you know, going nuts.
Right.
But when I got here, there were maybe 18, something like that, and everybody played in every group. I mean, it was totally nuts. And so then the question became, well, do I teach all 18 of them? What did the TAs do? You know, coming up with some kind of balance, you know, do the TAs teach the freshmen and then I teach the rest, or do I teach the freshmen and the seniors and the grads and then the TAs teach the juniors and seniors? Which are the most important formative years? You know, I don't want to, as we grow the studio, I can't teach everybody. Because, you know, I don't do half-hour lessons. Everybody gets an hour, plus studio class, plus pedagogy seminar, plus I teach a recording class as well, plus percussion ensemble at the Yin Yang, plus, you know, what, all the admin, plus my own practicing, plus all that. I mean, you know how it is. It's like, it's ridiculous. So,
is that how it's listed in the catalog? Is it percussion ensemble at the Yin Yang?
At the Yin Yang, yeah. So it's like, God, you know, how am I going to do all this stuff? And so for a long time, we tried all kinds of different systems here, the TAs and I did. And the beautiful thing is that the admin doesn't really care what I do as long as the students are placed in the appropriate programs, they're getting jobs, and the conductors are happy. Like, those are the three things that matter. And as long as I'm doing, you know, big stuff with quotes, air quotes around it, you know, big stuff. So I guess, yeah, it was about 5 years ago. You and I may not have known each other, but I went through like this massive like breakdown, right?
I knew about it, not through you, but I knew about it from other.
Yeah,
I think what I remember is that it was, I think, wasn't it your turn to be president?
President.
And then it was Julie was the vice at that point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I remember, and then someone explained. So yeah.
Yeah, basically, I mean, it wasn't because of PAS that I had the breakdown. It was more of a personal thing. But I had this, like, massive, like, holy good God moment. And so I kind of stepped back from everything for a while. And when I came back to teaching, I sat down with the deans and we said, okay, well, how do we see this moving forward? You know, what's your load, you know, ideally going to be? And I said, well, what if I have the TAs teach the freshmen and sophomores, and I teach the juniors and seniors and grad students, and I'll do ensemble and studio class and this and blah, blah, blah. And they're sitting there with a calculator typing up all the hours, and they're like, that's almost two faculty loads. And I was like, well, that's how I see, like, the easy route. Like, that's how I see, like, giving myself a break. Like, that feels like phoning it in,
yeah.
You know, compared to what I was doing. And so we got a big laugh kind of out of it. But since then, it's actually worked out pretty well. So that's what I do now. But the TAs have an incredible amount of responsibility. I mean, the five that I have are amazing. I mean, they run percussion ensemble. The logistics around this place are just insane. I mean, they take care of that. They do the methods class. They run the drum line. They do all the community groups. They play in TSO. They handle all the instrument moves. They handle all of the stuff with the undergrads. They handle all the scheduling. I mean, they handle everything. I mean, I barely do anything. In fact, one of my friends just told me lately that she wants to be me when she grows up because I barely do anything. Like, all I do is show up and, like, sprinkle pixie dust on stuff and hopefully it gets better. And then I go, you know, jet skiing.
Right.
that's what it seems like sometimes. Right. Yeah, that's what it seems like sometimes. Yeah. But, you know, I do really rely on them a lot. And I think that's changed even more so than when I first got here. When I first got here, you know, I was much more of a control freak and they were there to help me control everything. And now I kind of let them run everything and I'm in much more of a kind of supervisory, stand back and let them figure it out kind of role. And that's been a true blessing. But I'm lucky, man. I've got incredible students. I mean, tons of incredible students. And I just let them do their thing. And, you know, when they need me, I'm there. And when they don't, I'm out jet skiing. So, or
jet skiing, you know, in quotes.
Or doing air quotes. Yeah, you know, or out, you know, doing whatever else I do, you know, losing bets to John Oval or, you know, whatever.
How many jet skis are in that studio, John?
I've just got one. That's enough. Yeah. That's enough.
Well, when I am curious though, like before you kind of had to like reassess.
Well, yes.
You know, if you know,
you can call it whatever you want. I'm not ashamed of it.
I mean, well, but I'm curious, like, where did you have like friends or some of your colleagues be like, John, are you all right? And like, would you, or would like, would you have check-ins like that, or was it just like, you have a very singular focus?
I don't know. If you had known me, I mean, I think people who know me and have known me for a long time, one of the things that they would always say to me is, how do you do all of this stuff at this level? Like, you know, I've always been the guy that can do, like, I can run this program, I can be out playing, I can learn how to be a professional audio engineer and a video engineer and an entrepreneur, and I can, you know, be a semi-pro tennis player, and I can be a jet skier, and I can learn how to do this, and I can do that, 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 and I can do all of these things. I can write articles, I can write blogs, I can do newspaper interviews, I can do all of this stuff because I've been really blessed with the ability to multitask like a wicked motherfucker. Mm-hmm. You know, like I can do a lot of stuff all at the same time.
Yeah.
And so I think more people were worried about the fact that I was burning, like, not candles, not the candle at both ends, but the candle with like 100 ends. Right. You know, it's like there's like a wagon wheel with 100 candles out of it, and they were all kind of converging on the center eventually. And I think that was probably more the concern. If you were asked, like, the people that really know me well, like Blake Tyson and Scott Herring and Tom Burritt and, you know, those guys that are like my best friend in the, or best friends in the profession, I think if you ask them, that's probably what they would say they were more worried about than anything. But, you know, my colleagues here, they don't know any better. I mean, this place is so big, I barely even know half the people I work with. I barely even see them.
Sure.
You know? I mean, I went to the first faculty meeting I've been to in 5 years, like, I don't know, 7 or 8 weeks ago, and I don't even think I recognized half the people in the room. So that's also because I hate meetings.
And that's because a different problem.
I'm full professor now, and I don't have to go to meetings if I don't want to. I just wanted to go to see what was up, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody's been going. I wanted to see what's happening, you know?
And then you go to the meeting, and you go, yeah, I don't need to...
No, actually, you know, it was fun. Plus, I've lost like 45 pounds and, you know, I had this suit that was taken in 6 inches everywhere. So I was like, yeah, I want to go to this meeting and be seen. I made a joke to the dean that I should have stood up when they introduced the new faculty members. Yeah, she was like, what are you doing here? And I was like, I thought I'd just come and see what this was all about. You know?
What are you crazy kids up to?
Yeah, there's some construction in front of one of the concert halls. I wanted to know what was going on, you know, since I clearly missed that.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah, I see what you mean. So does that mean you still multitask in the same way, or you just have fewer items on your multitasking?
I don't know. One of the nice things about New John, let's say, and there's like New John from 5 years ago, and then there's like really New John from like the last 4 months, is that I still have tons of stuff to do, but I'm much more, what's the word? It's not discerning. I'm much more picky about what I say yes to.
Sure.
So, like right now, I just pushed 2 huge audio projects off of my desk yesterday. I still have 5 more that need to hit soon and get those off of my desk. But we've got, you know, there's tons of stuff happening in the studio. I've got a whole bunch of orchestra weeks coming up. I've got, you know, all kinds of stuff. There are plates that are spinning all the time, you know, or flying up above my head. But the fun part now is that they're all like super fun, super exhilarating, cool plates. And I don't have – now I'm just not accepting any plates that I don't want anymore that aren't healthy or aren't fun or aren't for the benefit of my students or my kids or whatever else. I just won't do them. And that's one of the biggest differences. And that's one of the great things about getting tenure and getting promoted and getting to a point in your career where you don't have to do anything that you really don't want to do artistically or otherwise. You can just say no. And – you know, that's kind of a powerful thing to be able to do. And so I'm just trying to make sure that everything that I do now is something that I really, really, really believe in. And then it's not like work.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and so, you don't have, you've kind of set it up and built a program now where you've got the, you know how to kind of delineate tasks to your
To your grad students. I'm a wicked delegator now.
Yeah.
Because, well, I've also got the people around me that can do it, you know.
Right.
My grad students could run this place. I could totally take off for 2 months and come back and, I mean, maybe all of the stuff wouldn't be exactly where it would be if I were here the whole time, but it wouldn't be the end of the world. I mean, it would be great. You know, I mean, any one of these TAs could be running a college program with no hesitation at all and would do a great job. I mean, the kids that they're working with, these freshmen and sophomores, they're ridiculous. You know, I mean, they're not teaching non-majors. I mean, they're teaching some of the best undergrads in the country and they're killing it. So I trust them completely. And me being able to say that and me being able to say, okay, I'm going to go out of town for a week to go play with Naples or whatever, I'll see you guys when I get back, and knowing that everything is going to get taken care of and my phone never rings, I never get any emergency texts. So now, of course, I say this, and as soon as this thing comes out, like, the studio is going to, like, you know, the school's going to burn down or something, you know, but it's not going to be their fault. They're too responsible, but
they're
really amazing people, and, you know, I couldn't be more happy than I am to work with them.
Yeah. Speaking of things not burning down, how did you all survive the hurricane?
We were fine. I was actually on my way to Columbia to do this thing up with the Spark leadership group. It's David Cutler. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. Savvy musician, savvy music teacher, etc. I was going to do some stuff with him and Scott Herring up at USC, and so I left, and because they canceled classes here for a week, I'm so dumb. I didn't even know there was a hurricane in the Gulf until Monday morning. Because, like, one of the things I decided to do this summer is I got rid of Facebook completely, which I got to tell you has been amazing. And I decided to stop watching TV.
Oh.
Period. Mm. Like, I only watch Netflix.
Oh, there you go.
So no TV, no news, no nothing. So, and if I want to see any news, I'll read it. Mm-hmm. Right. So I try and avoid that too, except to get ready for the election.
Sure.
So I had no idea. So Monday morning, I'm getting text messages from the students, and they're like, can we take marimbas to our apartments?
You're like, no.
I'm like, for what? They're like, well, to practice. I'm like, well, why would you need to do that? Well, there's a Category 3 hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico. I was like, really? You know, I dial up the app, and I'm like, what's going on? Oh, and then they cancel school for the whole week.
Right.
So my first thought was, great, it's not a school night. I can, you know, go hang out tonight, you know, do whatever with my friends. And then, you know, I talked to Herring, and I was like, okay, I'll leave town, get up there. So, of course, I get up to Columbia, and then they cancel classes in Columbia because the storm went right up, and the eye of the storm was right over there on Thursday. So, anyway, long story short, we were fine. A lot of trees down, a lot of power outages. Some power is still not back on yet here in Tallahassee, but I was fine. My family's fine. All my friends' families are fine, but west of us was just leveled.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
like Panama City Beach, that area.
Oh, God. Like Mexico Beach is gone. Yeah. I mean, it's awful. I mean, it looks like somebody just dropped a bomb in the middle of it, or like a tornado just sat on top of it. It's heartbreaking, actually. But so that was horrible. But we by comparison, it was fine.
Yeah.
It was fine, but thanks for asking, though.
Yeah. How did the audio parts of your job or your career, did that start at Florida State, or is that something that you had been working on for a while?
This is a good question. I've always been interested in recording, but I'd always been on the other side of it. You know, I'd always been...
recorded.
Yeah, I'd always been on the other side. And when I got here... I mean, I still do this. I spend a lot of time thinking about things that I can do that will give the students an advantage. You know, if you have like equal student talent levels and intellect and, ensemble opportunities and level of playing and level of school and all that kind of stuff, then what are like the next things, right, that would give the students legs up? And so for me, it was like, okay. One of the things that I always tried to do when I was in grad school is I always recorded my lessons on mini disc recorders, right? You probably remember these. Mm-hmm. You're too young to remember this.
No, I remember. I mean, I didn't use them, but I know what you're talking about.
Right. Kind of like you remember record players. You probably never had one, but you remember.
I actually did,
they are,
still,
right?
Yeah, but.
Hey, they're coming
back,
man.
I had 45s.
So anyway.
Yeah.
So I had this little mini disc recorder, and I would use that for lessons and rehearsals and stuff. I mean, I remember in Eastman Wind Ensemble, before we went to Japan on Hunsberger's last tour, I was using these things to record our rehearsals. And the section and I would get together and listen to it and, you know, make decisions about instruments we were using and all that kind of stuff. I mean, this was serious business, right? So I thought, well, what if we had like a dedicated recording situation in our percussion studio? And so I started talking to some audio people, and I was also, I had like really bad insomnia on top of all of that other stuff we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And so I just stayed up at night and learned what I needed to figure out what we should do in order to be able to have this stuff and to be able to record everything to the computer. And so at FSU, my office is right beside the percussion studio. So I put together a little proposal, and I went upstairs and said, here's what I need. And they said, sure. And they came in and, you know, with whatever jackhammers and put holes in the walls and ran everything with conduit and everything so I could control everything from my office. So it was really just to start recording the students so that they could record their lessons and we could record rehearsals. And then we would, at this point, we were just putting up links to MP3s on private web pages, and then they could go and review all of their stuff.
Yep.
And then we started using flash drives. So I would record everything, and then they would come in and take it and stick it in the computer, and then they would take their lesson off, and we would do that. And then we went to Dropbox and started doing it that way. But then, and this is like over the last 10 years, now everybody just brings in their laptops. They all have the software loaded in. It's required, just like the same way I require mallets and sticks and books. They have the software, and they just come in and plug into one of the studio interfaces, and we have mics hanging all the time. So this way, I don't have to do anything. They just come in and record straight to their computers. So it all started with them just being able to have high-definition recordings that weren't Zoom recorders and weren't crappy, you know, iPhone recordings, you know, something they could really hear the difference when I played something and when they played something. But then, you know, pre-screening started. This is when everybody started saying, okay, now we need, in order to invite you to audition at our program, you need to send an audio recording. So then I went upstairs and said, now we need better equipment than everybody else too. So I want this pair of microphones, and I want these preamps, and I want this interface, and I want these cables, and I want this, and blah, blah, blah. Because there again, if we're competing with, you know, the North Texases and the Indianas and the Northwesterns and all these people to put our students at Juilliard, then we need to have better equipment than they do. So we went and got it. And so then I learned how to use all of that stuff. And then, of course, they started asking for video. So now I need better cameras than all of them have. So I went upstairs and said, now we need this camera, we need this camera. And then that, I got learned how to do all the video editing. And then now we need more cameras. And then through all of this, just from me screwing around, we started making our own CDs. You know, the percussion ensemble started recording. I joined a bunch of recording forums. My first ensemble disc, I think, was Line Upon Line's first CD. You know, this was all when I was just, like, learning how to do all this stuff. And what's happened is that it's kind of become its own beast. You know, now I have my own company. I do a lot of video work for the city that has nothing to do with music.
Yeah.
I master audio for people all over the world. Now I'm a Grammy voter. I'm actually part of the engineering wing for the Grammy Foundation. And I've recorded everybody. I just finished recording She-E in January, finished another Tom Burritt project that we did over the summer. I've been doing Will James's series, The Repertoire, with him, which is just fabulous. I mean, talk about somebody who's a joy to work with and listen to. I mean, he's just amazing. You know, Blake Tyson and Peyton McDonald and Omar and the Sothis project that's coming out. I mean, I've got tons of fun stuff to do. And working with people in that way versus playing with them, I found to be incredibly rewarding. Playing with them is awesome too, but getting to work with them and putting together something that's, you know, going to be around forever, that's pretty awesome. You know, performances are just maybe once or twice or maybe 10 times, but when you put something out there that's going to last a long time and you're, you know, working with them to make something super, super, super artistic, even at the most basic level, all the way up to the most crazy, you know, both technologically and musically, it's so fun. So it's, and not to mention that it has, I mean, there's nothing that will sharpen your ears like being a recording engineer.
Oh, I bet.
Nothing. And what's great is that many of the students have worked with me on these projects, and you know, they come in and sit with me and listen to me take stuff apart and watch me edit and listen to how I do it. And a lot of them have started their own companies because, hey, there are over 1,000 music majors here, and guess how many of them need pre-screening recordings? a lot. Yeah. And guess how many of them are going to use their iPhones and put it on a music stand and do it in their living room or their apartment in their T-shirts? Too many of them. So instead, now my students are actually, you know, paying for all of their equipment and starting their LLCs and using it as a tax write-off to go and record all this high-quality stuff for these students. So, I mean, they're, you know, entrepreneurship is such a big deal right now with music schools and, you know, alternative training and alternative outcomes and all those kinds of things. And, you know, we're living it here. So not only can they play, not only can they teach, but they've got this extra, you know, X factor that they've got that's super important. So, you know, they're getting into web design. I've got several of them that are budding photographers as well. And they're all audio engineers at some level. And they're all getting into video. And it's a rabbit hole, but it's super fun to go down it.
Oh, you kind of are glossing over this, but you keep saying like, and then I went upstairs and asked for this, and it's
oh, yeah.
I mean, it's is this things that I'm just curious, is this stuff that's like a budget thing? Are you writing grants to get some of this equipment, or
I probably should, but I have like the most amazing deans of getting stuff ever. Like, I have yet. I think the only time that I've ever been told no is when I asked for 25 iPad Pros, and I got laughed at. But I got two of them.
Just two more than zero.
I got two is more than zero. Always over ask. You know?
Yeah, right. Of course.
But I think they trust me upstairs. They know that everything that I come upstairs to ask for is to give the students an advantage and give them something that they're not going to get anywhere else. And so when I go up and I say I need a $3,500 camera, they don't bat an eye. If I say I need a $4,000 pair of microphones, they don't bat an eye. And I also don't go up there every year and say I need, you know, this marimba or I need that marimba. I mean, we have so much. We have a ludicrous amount of equipment here. I mean, we don't really need anything. I mean, would I like to have two octaves of Almglocken? Yeah. But, I mean, until we play at Expecto, I'm not going to need it. You know, really, we can just rent it from Weiss. So I'm very picky about what I ask for. And so they know that I really have researched it. They know that I'm going to use it. And they trust that it's going to enhance the student experience here. So they're very, very giving when it comes to that. And they're very respectful. So, yeah, I just go upstairs and say, this is what I want to do. And the students have, I mean, they know that the return on the investment is going to be super high. So, I mean, I have yet really, except for the iPad thing. And that was mostly a joke. I knew I wasn't going to get 25 of them, but I figured just a few might be nice.
Yeah.
Mission and accomplished. They are. They're great. You know, some Bluetooth pedals. And, you know, now we don't have to have those huge poster board, you know, 25 page scores up in front of us that look so stupid. You know, I'm just doing it all with pedals. It's great.
Yeah. Well, when you got to Florida State, how much equipment did they have a lot already? Oh, or you did?
No, they did not. But I guess it was about, I want to say probably, I don't know how many years ago it was. We went through this massive, we have five concert halls here. And our biggest hall, like the 1,800 seat hall, went through a 2-year massive reimagining. I mean, you can't even really call it a renovation. It was like this massive reimagining. And the dean at the time, Don Gibson, and I sat down and I said, look, you know, we looked at the stage plots and where the new rehearsal room was going to be and everything, and they weren't going to be on the same level. And I said, you know, what we really need is we need two full sets of gear up there because it wasn't connected to this building. I was like, let's not ever have to move anything. Let's just leave one full set of gear in one room and one full set at stage level, and then we never have to go back and forth. And he said, sure. So we ended up buying, you know, duplicate sets of super high-end gear for both of those rooms, which meant that we then got to take the one set that was up in the hall before and rotate that down to the studio, and then take the studio gear and rotate that to one of the rehearsal rooms, and then rotate everything down. And we already had like three sets. No, we had four sets of lights already. So then we got two more sets of the Adams Dresden drums. And we had two sets of pedal action drums. I think they had 2 5 octaves, and now we have 7 or something like that. I mean, it sounds like a lot, but we need it. I mean, we've got, you know, almost 30 students that need to practice all the time. And we need that many instruments. I mean, we've got we have a ton of stuff. I mean, a ton. But the nice thing is that every rehearsal space has its own basic gear. So all you have to really bring is your own stuff and hardware. And so it's worked out really, really well. But yeah, it took a long time to build up the inventory to where it is right now. But it's pretty amazing, actually. Yeah. We're lucky. And there again, you know, I go upstairs. I don't go upstairs and say, okay, I need 4 marimbas or else I'm applying for jobs. You know, the way that some people do. You know, I just go up there when I want something and I say, you know, okay, here's why we need this. And I'm willing to wait a year if you want to, you know, budget, you know, for this for next year or budget for 2 years. You know, if I wanted to go up and say, all right, it'd be really great if we had 2 more sets of timpani, and I realize that we can't do that right now. So how about if we just look at it for the next 2 years and, you know, do it that way? And I think if I've learned anything about working with administrators, they really do appreciate it if you do all the planning and thinking for them in front, and then they can just look at it and say, you know, more like a judge. If you're more like an attorney and you just present a case, mm-hmm. it's easier for them than if you go upstairs and say, well, I need this and I need that and I must have this and I must have that or else. And that's just not the way to approach it. And unfortunately, I think as percussionists, you know, we're always on the hunt for gear. And, you know, going into an administrator and saying, you know, I must have is maybe, even if it's true, that's maybe not the best approach.
Yeah.
At least, you know, for me, that's, you know, and I'm such a jerk anyway. I try not to come off as one when I'm asking for stuff.
I mean, you could get it if you want to, but, you know, right.
I know. It's like, I don't want to do that. I mean, it's like, all right, I want to go and say, all right, here's what we're looking at. I mean, we found, God, when I got here, I found 3 sets of old Deegan Glockenspiel bars in a box, like in this back room, and like 2 sets of like Deegan 870 xylophone bars and resonators.
Yeah.
And so I went upstairs and I was like, oh my God. I was like, we don't need to buy new xylophones for Glockenspiel. So we just need to get somebody to build these for us. You know, this is going to be a fraction of the cost.
Yeah.
Here are the people that do this kind of work. Mm-hmm. I've already talked to them. Here are the estimates. Here's how much this would cost if we bought new ones. Here's how much these instruments will be worth if we refurbish them and rebuild them. And here's the impact that they'll have because here's where we can place them and everything. And they were like, oh, yeah, this is a no-brainer. Okay, do it.
Yeah.
You know, versus going upstairs and saying, I need new stuff mm-hmm. now right. or else.
Yeah.
You know?
So don't do that is what you're saying.
Right. I wouldn't do that. I mean, but, you know, my whole life has been a repository of stories of don't do that. Like, I could tell you stuff you wouldn't believe of stupid stuff that I've done at school and dumb things I've done, said, and, you know, ways I've acted. And I've just been really lucky never to have to pay for it. So, you know, other than getting some really good stories out of it.
Yeah. I hear you.
Yeah. I do a lot of stupid stuff, Pete.
Yeah. I'm happy to hear that, and feel free to chime right in with one of those stories anytime. But before I get to that,
I'll give you one good one. All right, I'll give you one good one.
Yeah.
So, okay, this is a good one. We spent I don't know about $12,000, maybe my second or third year taking. We have all right. So Gary Wertesheim, who was my predecessor here. Fabulous musician, fabulous timpanist, one of Saul Goodman's students from Juilliard. I mean, just fabulous musician. And so as he was a timpanist, we had these 3 sets of lights from like 1971. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things are amazing, like old Mark 11s. But all the pawls had been stripped, the ratchets and pawls had been stripped, and the tuning indicators had been banged off, and, you know, they weren't in very good shape. So again, I went upstairs and said, I talked with Marshall out of American Drum, and I said, you know, how much would it cost to replace all these pieces? And then we would strip the drums down and repaint them with a 2-part epoxy and redo the counter hoops and redo all that stuff ourselves without shipping them off to you. And the kids and I will learn how to do it all. And you just send us the parts. So it ended up being, instead of, you know, shipping 3 sets of drums out there and having them completely refurbish them and ship them back to us and us losing the drums for God knows how long, it costs like $12,000 to get all the stuff built for us and sent out to us, and then we did all the work ourselves. So in one of the rehearsal rooms, the jazz ensemble meets, and a bunch of guys were putting their cases on top of the drums.
Oh, great.
So I went in and talked to the jazz ensemble director and said, you know, hey, can you guys, you know, not do this because we just spent all this money on these drums, and you really shouldn't do that anyway, right? He said, yeah, man, no problem. I said, okay. So a couple weeks goes by, and one of my students comes in and says, hey, there's a trombone case on top of the drums, and there's something else in there. So they're big band's in there playing. And I go in, and I look at, and I see this soft trombone case. And so I go over to it, and I take everything out of it, and I walk over in front of the big band, and they're playing still. And I drop it on the floor, and then I start jumping up and down on it. Now, meanwhile, this is like my second year at Florida State. I'm not tenured. And then I point over at the timpani with one hand, and I wag my finger with the other one. And then I turn around, and I salute the jazz director, and I walk out. And I'm thinking, problem solved.
Oh, my God. Well, that was your first clue.
Right, problem solved.
Problem solved.
I go out, and I, you know, go back into rehearsal or whatever it was that I was doing. And so then 2 hours later, I come out, and, you know, my inbox, my email inbox, first thing on it is an email from the jazz ensemble director, and it's copied to, like, every person at Florida State, like the deans, Cliff Madsen.
Bobby Bowden, like, probably was on it, too.
Might as well have been Bobby Bowden, for Christ's sake. I mean, it was like everybody was on there, and it was like 3 pages of how unprofessional I am and what a horrible colleague I am and how, you know, how dare I, you know, this kind of thing. Uh-huh. And, you know, I was just like, at first, I mean, I was so jaded by, I was caught by surprise because I thought it was pretty funny. I thought I'd handled it well. Little did I know that I had not handled it well. So I had to rebuild some paths there. And now it's Leon Anderson, who's like one of my favorite colleagues. He's our drum set guy and runs the jazz studies program. We still laugh about that. Like, to this day. Like, but you know what? We haven't had any cases on top of the drums ever since.
That's right. Yeah.
So I guess if you want to say, all right, did it work? Yes. Was there a better way to do it? Absolutely. There probably was. But fortunately, I didn't have to pay for it. I didn't get a letter in my file.
Right.
And I ended up apologizing to everybody, and everything was fine. But, you know, just stupid stuff like that. And I've got tons of stupid stories like that just because I'm an idiot. But I've become a little less idiotic as of late. Well, I mean, I still am an idiot, but I just don't do things that are that overtly stupid, you know?
I was thinking, you're probably thinking, I just spent the last 2 hours high-fiving myself with how brilliant of a move this was.
Oh, yeah, I was like, that was great. It was like, that was really funny,
yeah.
And, you know, I got the point across, and those kids probably never do that again. And little did I know, Leon was like, you know, coming from my head, you know?
Sweet.
And yeah, it's, and that's okay. That's something that's really, it's like perspective, man. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought, it never occurred to me to think about what would I think if somebody came into my room during one of my rehearsals and did something like that.
Right. Yeah.
It'd be easy for me to say, I would never have done what they did to us, because, I mean, we're better citizens than that.
Yeah.
But even if they did, like, to come in and be like, oh, one of your students left a chair in our room or did this or left their food in the hallway or something, came in and made such a, like, dumped a bunch of trash
right.
in my studio while I was rehearsing because one of the kids left a drink bottle in the hallway or something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, how pissed off I would be.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, that never occurred to me because I didn't even think of it.
Mm-hmm.
So perspective, if there's anything you were asking earlier, like what's different between now and then,
mm-hmm.
fucking perspective.
Yes. Yes.
That's what's different.
I gotcha. The one last thing about the recording part is, at what point did it become clear to you that you needed to, that this actually needed to be a separate business?
Well, I mean, from a tax perspective, well, actually, from two perspectives. One is that it sets up a conflict of interest to use university equipment to make money for yourself personally, right? So I can't use stuff that the school buys for the students to make money for me, John. It's like, so if you call me and you say, hey, I want you to come and record my next CD, I need to have all of my own equipment for my own company to come and do it to keep it nice and clean. Right. If I bring all of FSU's equipment and do that, then that's technically something I would need to report to the university.
Right.
Right. So I just wanted to avoid all of that and say, OK, if I set up the business, then all the equipment that I buy, I can write that off on my taxes. Right. So that way it just keeps everything nice and clean. I have a business credit card that I just use for business stuff. So it keeps all my, I don't have to keep receipts or anything. I can just keep those credit card statements. send it to my tax guy, and everything that's on that credit card is deductible. So it just ends up keeping things a lot nicer and neater, and then I'm free to do what I want to do, and I don't have to worry about the university, you know, getting angry because I'm using their gear or something. Not that they would care. I mean, this place is so big, and there's so much going on. I think I'd probably be somewhere near the 10 millionth thing that they would need to worry about, but I just like to set a good example when I can for the kids so they understand how this stuff works.
Yeah.
Obviously, jumping up and down on a trombone case is not a good example. That's one that I try to point out to them. Don't always do as I do, but do as I say do.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
You could tell that story. Just don't do that.
Right. Try not to, you know, if you get to that point, this is what I tell the students. So like, if you get to that point with a colleague, you call me and you tell me what you think you're getting ready to do, and I'll tell you whether or not it's a good idea. Like, if your spider sense starts to tingle, call me because I'm an expert. Like, you know, when you think it's, is it a good idea to send this email? Step away from the keyboard.
Right.
That's why when I write emails like that, I don't even have an address in the to line because I don't want to, like, some weird combination of keys send it by accident. Before,
yeah.
Right, you know?
Yeah.
I've done that too. I've done that before.
Yeah. I hear you.
So yeah, it's like there's like a whole series of things that I teach students about how to keep your job, which is like sometimes even more crazy than how to get one.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Like, how do you keep it once you've got it? It's like, that's something that nobody ever really talks about. And that's like super, super important. Like, how to be a good colleague. Like, mm-hmm. What does that actually mean? You know, beyond doing your job and doing a great job with the students, like, what does it mean to actually work in a university environment or with an orchestra or, you know, with a military band? You know, and the number one thing is, you know, you got to get along with everybody. And that's, God, that's so important. And you can't be an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can be, but you can't be that way all the time. I mean, if you are, you're not going to get tenured.
Or if you do, you're going to be around everyone who's angry with you that you got.
Yeah, they're just not going to. I mean, nobody wants to go to work with. I mean, that's the whole thing. Nobody wants to work with people they don't like. I mean, some people have to, but they don't like it. So just don't be that person if you can help it. Just be that person away.
Right.
You know, try and keep work nice and clean and easy and. You know, it's easy for me to say. I barely see anybody. I'm in like one of two rooms all day long.
It was a couple years ago that you had you kind of discovered something with the percussion ensemble. The competition.
Yes.
Can we talk about that?
Sure. I don't mind.
Remind me again what happened. Because I remember reading about it, like reading your post about it, and then there's kind of like a whole ripple effect kind of happened, I think.
There was. Well, what happened was I was judging.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the high school judges.
Yeah.
And so what had happened was there were a couple of the submissions, I think it was two, in the high school category that had nothing but static on their recordings. So it literally sounded like... Or, you know, just like white noise. And so I gave them both zeros. I don't remember what the title, you know, whether it was like 1 to 10. I don't remember how we were judging those kinds of things. But I basically just gave them both F, you know, on a scale of A to F. I gave them both Fs.
Yeah.
Because I was like, all right, if you don't even listen to your recording before you send it in, you know, forget it, you know. So anyway, flash forward however many weeks and the results come out. Right. And we had also applied. I mean, we hadn't applied since we won the last time, which is like 2011, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so we applied. And of course, I take incredible care with our live recordings. So, I mean, you may not like what we play, but it's going to sound amazing.
Right.
You know, so anyway, we get all the results back. And I remember Scott Herring called and he was like, dude, like the judges are all saying that they couldn't hear one of the tracks on my disc. Or on my recordings. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, yeah, it says that they can't tell what we're playing and there's a bunch of static and white noise. And I went back and listened to what we submitted and that's not what's on there. Like, they're saying they can't hear it. I wonder if we got graded down for it. And I was like, well, it's interesting you say that because I definitely graded down, you know, at least two high schools for it for bad recording quality. And then I got ours. And evidently it had happened to our recording too. And I was like, what is going on? So I did some digging, and I talked to Eric Willey, and I talked to a couple other people, and I was like, what is happening? Well, it turns out that there was a thing in the application that said that they wanted you to submit everything as an MP3 file, which I guess that in the college division, there were 8 out of the 15, or I don't remember the numbers exactly, so please don't quote me on it. You can read it on my blog. I think the article's still up. But however many of it, there were a lot, including Brian Zader, including some other people who should have known better if this was going to be a rule. I just missed it, personally. And so anyway, they had somebody in the office converted all of our WAV files into MP3s, but when they did it, they chose the wrong algorithm and added white noise to all of them.
Oh, wow.
So basically, it corrupted the files of the groups that were not submitted as MP3s. Now, if it were one or two of them, maybe that's a big deal. So now it's also important to know that I called attention to it immediately. And was like, okay, what's going on? I talked to the chair of the percussion ensemble committee. I wrote the other judges. I said, what's going on? What do you guys think about this? We need to do this again. I mean, if this is a widespread thing, we need to run the contest again, because this isn't fair. And it's all in the article, what happened, all the interactions, going back and forth. So basically, PAS comes back and asks all the judges, do you think it would impact your judging if we ran this again and you were actually able to hear everything? And miraculously, the judges came back and said, no, it wouldn't have impacted our judging. And I'm like, are you deaf? It's like asking if you could shoot free throws with a blindfold over your eyes. I mean, of course it impacts your judging. You can't hear it. I was like, I gave two of these groups zeros because I couldn't even tell what it was. How can you say that? And they're like, no, sorry, we're not going to do anything about it. And then I found out. Then they wrote and they were like, well, those groups should have been disqualified anyway because they didn't submit the file in the proper format. But here's the other thing. The people that submitted, they make all the members and the director be a PAS member. Your membership has to be active in order to apply. But it turns out with a lot of the groups, not everybody was active. But the office contacted all of those people and said, you have to pay. So they contacted people. I mean, they should have disqualified those people because they didn't meet the requirements, right? But they contacted them about the money, but didn't contact any of us about the fact that we submitted a recording in the wrong format. Now, it's also important to note that this was the first year that they had gone to an online submission instead of a CD, and that the Percussion Ensemble Committee hadn't even been asked about it. Like, Eric didn't even know that all this stuff was being done through Dropbox for the first time. So there were all these things that were happening. So anyway, Eric, we were going to run it again. They were going to get another set of judges. They were going to get all this stuff, blah, 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 et cetera. Well, I went to the EC. Of course, I was part of it before. I know how those things work. And I said, I pleaded with them. I pleaded with Julie. I pleaded with Paul Beyer. And I said, you guys can't do this. I was like, you can't. There's already so much suspect activity from the membership's perspective of what goes on in the executive committee. I've been on both sides of it. You can't let this slide. I mean, if you do this, you're basically saying we don't care about the rules. And they're like, no, we've made the decision. That's it. And that's when I said, okay, then you've made your decision and I'm getting ready to make one too. And that's when I decided to write that article. And then it went viral and everybody went crazy. But here's the good thing that happened from it. Turns out that Lone Star High School was one of the group, the one that ended up – so step back for 1 second.
Yep.
The guy at Lone Star, whose name I can't remember. It's not the same guy there now, and I feel horrible for saying that because we went back and forth a few times. I mean, they spent so much money on their recording sessions, and this is a school that, like, half the kids have doctors and lawyers for parents, and half of them are, like, don't have anything. Like, they were basically – like, he was – paying for kids to be members, They spent all this money. They did all this stuff. They made this huge deal, and their recording was one of the ones that I gave a zero to.
Yeah.
And when it left their house, it sounded great, and it got screwed up by PAS. He sent me a letter that he was going to send to the EC where he was like, look, there's some people here that are thinking about legal action, for doing this. I mean, it's clear because he read my article and contacted me and was like, was our group, you know, did we figured out who it was. I said, you should send it to him, man. So he did. And then the next day, the official PAS response came out and said, there were mistakes on both sides, is what it said, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But they decided to run another abbreviated contest with the – they were going to keep the three groups that won, or the groups that won, but they were going to run one more spot for college and one more spot for high school of the tapes that were still in there. I, of course, took ours out. I was like, I am not – we're done. You know, we're out of it. And so then North Texas got a spot. And then guess who won the other one? It was Lone Star.
Mm.
And believe me, they would have won. I heard their submission from them. They would have been one of the winners, yeah, straight up.
Yeah.
All day long and twice on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being good because there were two extra spots for groups that wouldn't have gotten to play, which was great. But, you know, it was tough because, I mean, they're – all those people were my friends. I mean, Tom Burrett, you know, played that year, and I remember telling him, I mean, he knew, you know, the stuff had been announced, and I told him what I was going to do, and I said, look, this doesn't reflect on you, and I don't want your kids to feel like I'm being some kind of jerk, but this is a big deal, and I feel strongly about it, and I just want you to know. He read it before I posted it, and I didn't contact Dave, but he and I have talked about it since. Dave Hall, mm-hmm, from Nebraska, you know, yeah, who's just doing an amazing job up there.
Yep. Yeah.
And Jerry Noble and I went back and forth on it, I think it's fair to say, for a little while. But, you know, he and I are in a good place now. And you know, the fact is, I would do it again right now. I don't care who the president is. If it were you, you know, never say never, you know, never say never. If it were Scott Herring, Blake Tyson, Tom Burrett, and Mike Burrett, if they were the EC and they did that, I mean, A, they wouldn't have done it, but B, right, if they did do that, I would still have written the same article and done the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And what I hope came across from all of that is that I tried every single step of the way to get them to understand the gravity of the mistake that they were making, from a judge's standpoint, who had judged the contest several times, from a winner's standpoint, who had won the thing twice with my kids, mm-hmm, from an audio engineering standpoint, because I'm the only professional audio engineer that's involved in this entire process. So I understand the file conversions, I understand the recordings, I understand the editing process, mm-hmm, and also was the only person who has been on the executive committee.
Right.
I was the only one who had all those viewpoints, and no one seemed to want to listen, and so I had to put it out there. And surprisingly, the response was overwhelmingly positive. So I felt really good about that. And, you know, it turns out the next year they changed the requirements. So for whatever consternation it caused and for some bridges that were burned with people who, you know, maybe they were my friends before and they're not now. If that's all it took to keep them from being my friends, then maybe they weren't. And it was worth it, because if you mess with the student experience, from my standpoint, if you basically poo-poo on all the hard work that all those students did because you're afraid to admit a mistake, that you deserve every bit of consternation you get in public, especially when you had a chance to fix it. And I'll never take that back. I was the only one who was in a position to not care about what was going to be lost.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious, yeah, was that you, because you were willing to, like you said, pull your part of this out of the process, that was like another perspective that no one else had that opportunity either.
I mean, I think other people could have said that. I mean, they could have said, well, I'll take, you know, if this is how you're going to do it, then I'm just never going to apply again, or I'm never going to, you know, I don't want my group considered. But there were also a lot of people involved there that are going to be future leaders of the organization. And I think for them, it's like, well, I can't get on board with this officially, because what if I do want to end up on the board of directors eventually? Or what if I do want to end up, you know, being elected to the EC or being a committee chair or something like this? I mean, you know, in other words, I was the only one who had nothing to lose.
Like, yeah.
I'm not going to be on the EC again. I'm not on the board of directors anymore. I'm not a committee chairperson. I'm not even a member anymore. And, you know, I was at that point just because I had to be for the competition. But as soon as that was over, I got my membership money back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the end. So, and the thing is, you know, I this is maybe it's going to sound kind of callous, but I don't mean for it to be, because I have a ton of respect for so many people that are involved in that organization. But, you know, people say, well, PAS did so much for your career. Oh, I paid back in spades what PAS did for my career. I paid it back in blood, sweat, and tears and bullshit. Not just over that percussion ensemble thing, but just over a lot of experience that most people don't know about. The people know, you know, that are close to me but don't know about. I paid off all of that through every level of leadership, through three states, through every step on the way up the ladder to being president. I dealt with a whole lot of stuff. And a lot of those experiences were great, and a lot of them were horrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I survived it, and it's great, and I wish the organization the best. I really do. But it's I don't need it in my life, and I don't need it for my career, and I don't need it for my program. I encourage the students to make their own choices, and if they want to take part in those competitions and do those things, then they're going to need to be members, and I encourage them to go to PASIC because it's an incredible experience. But you will not see me in the exhibit halls anytime soon, just because I'm not interested. I can see all my friends other ways, and I can find all kinds of other ways to make an impact in our, you know, artistically and musically and pedagogically, you know, both nationally and internationally, without having to be on that stage for that competition. So, and I knew that when I put that out there, I knew that that was pretty much going to ruin any chance for me to do it. And the beautiful thing about this point in my career is that I don't need it. So it's, you know, maybe other people feel differently about it, and that's fine. It's one of the great things about being an American. You know, you don't get locked up for this kind of stuff.
That you can see that you knew where you stood, like personally, on it at every stage. I think that's a lot of self awareness.
Oh yeah, sure. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I had advisors. I mean, I bounced that off several people before. I mean, I said this is what I'm thinking of doing. They were like, absolutely. And there's really only one person who can do it because we can't. Mm-hmm. You know, because they still want to do things and I don't have to. So it made total sense. But I was still, even if I had been in a position to feel like I don't want to do something that's going to cause people to remember me in a bad light because I want to have something to do later. You know, in other words, I don't want to lose the opportunity to give clinics, or I don't want to lose the opportunity to have more opportunities to do things. I mean, you know, even if I didn't do that, I still would have figured out a way to change the process somehow. But what frustrated me was that it was just kind of like giving someone all the evidence in the world that pool water is not actually blue. It's the paint of the pool.
Right.
You know, the paint is, that's what turns it blue. I was giving them all the evidence and they were just like, no, the water's blue. I'm sorry. And we're not going to admit it. Or you know what? Maybe the water isn't blue, but we're not going to change that. And it's just like, well, I'm sorry then. We're going to publish the evidence. Mm. Sorry.
Stay tuned for part two of John W. Parks IV, coming out next week. This week's rave is the newest version of A Star Is Born, currently in theaters and starring Lady Gaga, and directed, co-written, and co-starring Bradley Cooper. This is the fourth version of the movie by the same name, and the fifth total. In 1932, a film called What Price, Hollywood, came out, telling the same story and starring Constance Bennett and Lowell Sherman. In 1937, the first A Star Is Born with that title came out, starring Janet Gaynor and Frederick March. The gold standard is the 1954 version, which starred Judy Garland and James Mason, and the middling 1976 version, which starred Kris Kristofferson and Barbara Streisand. So the story's been told a lot. The premise is the relationship between a rising newcomer female star and a failing and falling drug and alcohol dependent male star. It's a classic tale that is fairly easy to translate on screen. Overall, this movie worked really well. Lady Gaga, for sure, played a pop star version of herself, but she stretched out and was very convincing in the up-and-coming role and in her first major film role. The film included lots of cameos by Alec Baldwin, Brandi Carlile, and a number of other folks. There were three really good supporting roles by Dave Chappelle as Bradley Cooper's friend, Sam Elliott as his older brother and frequent sparring partner, and I can't believe I'm saying this, Andrew Dice Clay. Yes, that guy is fantastic playing Lady Gaga's father in the movie. And it took a few minutes for me to even realize that was who was playing the character. That's a testament to the makeup department and also how shockingly good he is in the movie. And then there's the music, which again, really good. All the music is original, mostly written by Gaga and Bradley Cooper. There's lots of focus on the song Shallow, which is probably the best part of the movie. Along the way, there's lots of great music written by Bradley Cooper, too. He's really good also at the acting, directing, and writing part. I mean, that guy seems to be plenty talented and hardworking. And he's doing all right. It's a good show to catch while it's still in theaters, so check out the newest installment of A Star Is Born. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. Find all past episodes and show notes on the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud and Stitcher. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can contact me there, on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll be back next week with part two with John W. Parks IV. Until then.